Miller were living the American dream. They had good jobs. They had a beautiful baby. They lived in a nice house. They attended church. He exhibited a lot of flu-like symptoms, vomiting, fevers, headaches, and people generally thought that he had a virus or that he had a bacterial infection that they just couldn't isolate. He had been receiving small doses of arsenic for a long period of time.
At least 5-6 months worth of time.
The investigators believe the first attempt on Eric's life had come on November 15th.
We think Ann had talked Daryl into poisoning Eric based on the fact that he ended up killing himself. I think he realized that he was in over his head and he had been manipulated beyond things that he would normally do.
Hi, this is True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Welcome to another special Saturday edition.
Yes, we were going to wait until Tuesday, but I was so excited to announce our snifter winner. I decided, oh heck, let's just do it today.
Let's do one today.
Okay.
And so who's the lucky winner?
The lucky winner is Frankie White.
Way to go, Frankie.
Yep, Frankie wrote a very nice 5-star review. That's not to say that everybody else didn't. It was painful. Tell them how painful it was for me to pick Frankie.
You stressed about this for the last 3 or 4 days, trying to pick one.
I did.
There were so many excellent entries.
Well, people are so nice. It's just surprising that people are that nice. There were really some great reviews. So
there truly were.
So, Frankie, I just need you to, we're going to send you an email, and then you just need to respond with your address, and we're going to send that snifter right out on Monday or Tuesday. So you'll get it right away. And thanks for everybody that entered. We'll have another contest before Christmas anyway.
I think we should. This went over pretty well, it seems, and we love getting those reviews.
Well, and they help. They help us find more listeners, which is really important to keep us going. We need more listeners all the time.
We do.
Yeah. So what are we doing tonight? We're doing The Murder of Eric Miller. It's called Pretty Poison.
That's a good title.
Yeah, thanks.
Although pretty and poison don't actually go together, do they?
No, that's kind of my description of Ann Miller. She was pretty poison.
Ah, good one.
Yeah. So let me just give a quick little overview of this story, and then we'll do we have our first voicemail to play. Totally excited. So lots of exciting stuff today.
All right.
Yeah. So let me give a quick overview. We'll play our first voicemail. I'll just do a couple 5-star reviews, and we'll do the beer. Sounds like a lot to do, but it'll be fun stuff.
I'm up for it.
Okay. So Pretty Poison. Eric Miller's death was actually very painful and heartbreaking. A young research scientist with a pretty wife and a beautiful young daughter, Eric seemed to be living an ideal life. Now, a sudden, undiagnosed illness was killing him from within. He'd been struck down suddenly with severe stomach pains. Those who loved Eric were devastated and confused. Eric had been hospitalized 2 weeks earlier with similar symptoms. Just as he seemed to be recovering, though, his wife Anne rushed him back to the hospital with severe nausea and intestinal pain. And this time his symptoms were fatal. Eric died on December 2nd, 2000, at the young age of 30 years old. So, quite a shame. Tragic.
Way too early.
Yes, absolutely.
In a previously healthy male.
Yes. And just seemed like a super nice guy. I know everybody says that when people die, but this guy seemed genuinely nice.
From all we've read about him, absolutely.
Yeah. So, like I said, we got our first voicemail from Kathleen. So I'm going to play that now, and then we'll do our 5-star review. So here we go, our first voicemail.
Let's go, Kathleen.
Okay, wow, this is cool. Not only do I get a snifter from you, but now I learned how to send a voicemail through the website. Anyway, this is Kathleen Phil, also known as Vexed Vixen. Thank you so very much for the snifter. It was a wonderful surprise today. I really appreciate it. I hope you guys have continued success with your podcasts. I look forward to them every Tuesday. And I hope you can do something with that suggestion I sent you about Marjorie Congdon. That's actually a pretty interesting story from beginning to end. She does everything from kill people to become a serial arsonist. So anyway, thank you again. This is in addition to the email I just sent you, but I'm truly grateful and it was really cool to get that. So thank you and I have a good one.
Oh, Kathleen, you're so welcome. What a great voicemail that was. And you're very welcome for your snifter. Thank you for supporting us. And just so you know, also, Marjorie Congdon is on my to-do list, so we probably will do that at some point. That is an interesting case. Now, a couple of five-star reviews that are written, not voicemails. And a real fun one here is from Sharon. And I have to say, Sharon was probably my top five for the snifter contest. So it is called, OMG, you both are awesome. Well, from Sharon. I mean, how can you beat that?
Who can argue with that?
Yeah. So the whole review is, that is all I have to say. Awesome, awesome, and more awesome. Sharon loves you. So, welcome to the brewery, Sharon.
Way to go.
And then another one is from Daryl. And Daryl says, I want a snifter. There's still hope, Daryl. Don't give up. Daryl wrote, hey guys, I know you don't like to read all these mushy reviews, so I won't put you through that. My favorite part is when you subtly, and sometimes not so subtly, make fun of the criminal's stupidity. At those moments, you are saying what all your listeners are thinking. Also, I like it when you say fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Thank you for that. Daryl.
Okay, Daryl.
So Daryl and Sharon
were a unique take on things.
Daryl and Sharon were very entertaining.
Yes, they were.
They were definitely in my top 10, the both of them. And then one more I'm going to read from Logan Capo. And Logan says, 5 stars. I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts while at work, and the big one thing for me is the host's voice. I don't like the voice, I can't listen to it. But what I like about True Crime Brewery is you two have voices I could listen to all day. Great audio as well. This is an awesome podcast, and I always look forward to the next episode. Thanks too, Dick. My new goal is to go back and try all the beers you have reviewed. And hopefully, it's in the giveaway snifter. Thank you guys, and keep up the amazing work.
Great review.
Yeah. Welcome to the brewery, Logan.
Way to go.
Did I say welcome to the brewery, Daryl? I think I might have forgot.
Well, okay, you said it now.
Welcome to the brewery, Daryl, in case I didn't say it sooner. Okay, Dick, I know you're chomping at the bit to give us your beer review. Let's go.
Here's another beer. Interestingly, this is a North Carolina case. We've done 3 cases now in North Carolina. The staircase series, the little girl who disappeared.
Well, there were a few of those. Which
Erica.
One? Oh, was that North Carolina?
Was that her name?
Erica Parsons?
Erica Parsons, little adopted girl. Yeah.
Yeah, and just as North a Carolina. Quick aside, they did find her body this past week.
Right.
We got some links from some of our listeners about that. And her adopted father took the police to where her body is.
It looks like he's rolling over on the wife.
We thought that the wife did it, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with
we'll
that.
See.
But rest in peace, Erica.
Erica.
Yeah.
So, again, yet another North Carolina crime. For this one, I chose Dark Age Bourbon Barrel Aged Imperial Stout, which is brewed by Wicked Weed Brewing in Asheville. Now, Wicked Weed is one of those up-and-coming breweries. I really wish they distributed here in the Northeast.
Yeah, they don't?
Not yet.
Okay.
So, it is a Russian Imperial Stout, which I've talked about a few times before because that style is one of my favorites. I think if you're interested in learning exactly what it is, look at Thrill Kill, the Tim Bosma story.
Mm-hmm.
That has a Russian Imperial Stout.
Okay.
And The Devil Inside, the story of Donnie Rudd, has an Imperial Stout.
Right.
Anyway, this one is from Wicked Weed, Dark Age Bourbon Barrel Aged. And as I've said before, the Russian Imperial Stouts are kind of the big boy stouts. This one certainly is. It's 12% alcohol by volume.
Wow, that's a lot.
So, it's, surprisingly though, it's not as heavy as it sounds. It is a near black beer with a bubbly mocha-colored head that dissipates in a few minutes and leaves a ring of foam. The aroma is bourbon, dark chocolate, and vanilla. Very nice. More of a dark chocolate taste. The bourbon is there without being overbearing, and there's some vanilla. This is a big-bodied beer, but smooth, incredibly smooth.
Mm.
So if you didn't know you were sitting there with a 12%er, you might overindulge.
Uh-oh, so be it could careful. Be dangerous, yeah.
It can be dangerous.
So that one comes with a warning. All right, let's open that up. What are we drinking it out of? What are our glasses today?
We'll do the ubiquitous snifter.
All right, and pretty soon Frankie White will be able to join us with his snifter.
That's right.
That's right.
I hope he'll do that as he's listening to us.
Yeah, I hope so. Although
he listens while he drives his truck.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think he's a truck driver, maybe not.
Drink the snifter or use the snifter after he's done driving.
Sure, or you could drink coffee out of it.
Right.
But that wouldn't be much fun.
Not at all.
No. Okay, let's open it up and then we can head on down.
Yeah, it's crazy down that end.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, Saturday nights, you know.
Saturday nights, college football, a lot of rowdy people here.
Yeah, but the quiet end has been, the bartenders actually saved it for us tonight, I think, because we're getting in the habit of being there on a lot of Saturdays lately.
Right, and it looks like they've chased some people off, so
yeah,
we're in luck.
Yeah, that's because I gave him some of our True Crime Brewery coasters.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, kind of paving our way in there.
Good choice.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about our case.
Okay.
So first, some background on our victim, Eric Miller, who seems to have been a very good man, as I mentioned. I always think it's important to get to know the people involved and get some understanding of the personality and the events that lead up to the events of a crime. Now, Eric Miller was born in 1970 in Cambridge City, Indiana, to Doris and Varus Miller. It was a small town where everyone knew each other, and Eric had two older sisters who loved him very much, Pam and Leanne. Now, Eric attended Lincoln High School. He was class vice president, a member of the National Honor Society, and he played on the school tennis team. Eric's family was religious, and he'd been an altar boy at St. Elizabeth's Catholic Church. Friends have said that Eric was popular with girls in high school, but he was actually celibate. Because of his religion, he was saving sex until marriage.
Don't hear that too often, do you?
No, so it might just be that Anne was the only woman he ever had sex with. Just kind of sad.
That's a now sad, that we know chilling
who Anne
thought.
Is. Yeah,
yes.
Right. So Eric's wife, Anne, she was born Anne Renee Brer, and she was the oldest of three girls in her family. She was born in 1970, the same year as Eric, to Dan and Nancy Breyer. She had two younger sisters, Danielle and Sarah, who looked up to her quite a bit, and they also grew up in a small town, Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. Now, like Eric, Anne was popular, and she was also athletic. She played field hockey, she ran on the track team, and she also excelled academically.
Yeah, both of them did.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Two really intelligent people.
Right. Now, Eric met Anne in a biology class at Purdue University in Indiana. Now, that's a pretty difficult college to get into, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So they were both smart kids, smart young people. And they were both very ambitious. They had plans for careers in science. And not long after they met, the two did become a couple. Eric proposed to Anne on Valentine's Day of 1992, and she accepted. And the same year, they both graduated from Purdue with honors. I think Eric had a degree in biology and Anne in chemistry. I'm pretty sure that's what their degrees were in.
Right.
Yeah. And they married in 1993. They got married actually in Eric's family's Catholic church. And then they moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. And that's where Anne's family was. And they went there to pursue their doctoral degrees at North Carolina State University. So very ambitious, motivated people.
Very ambitious. Mm-hmm. So they both got master's degrees and entered the doctoral programs.
Right.
Eric finished his doctoral program, started work as an AIDS researcher at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Leinberger Cancer Center. Anne ended up dropping out after completing her master's. She didn't complete her doctoral program. And she took a job at a large pharmaceutical company. Anne's job paid very well. Big pharma, right?
Yeah.
And they moved into a better home, a bigger home, in 1997. With the ideal home and two great jobs, they're ready to start a family.
Sure, that's how it goes. If you're doing everything, boom, 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 in order.
Right.
Yep.
You know, they got married, what, they were 23, right? 73 they got married, so they're both 23. They're both fairly young.
Quite young. Yeah, I'd say more than fairly young. Well, that's young to get married, nowadays especially.
So they're ready to start the family. There's some struggles with infertility, and they went through in vitro fertilization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In January of 2000, their daughter, Claire, was born.
Okay.
Their daughter Claire was born at Rex Hospital.
Right,
which
right.
is the same hospital where Eric would die less than a year later.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of something to point out because it's just...
Didn't he die at UNC?
No, he was transferred there in his first admission, but when he was readmitted to the hospital, he went back to Rex, and that's actually where he died.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, his symptoms, they first appeared more than 2 weeks before his death. That was the first time. And it was after, it was like an after-work bowling outing, and it ended up leading to a 10-day hospital stay. And it started out, he had some severe stomach pains, some nausea, some vomiting. And at first, Eric thought he had food poisoning because he'd gone with a couple other guys. They were guys that worked with his wife, Anne.
Right.
And they'd gotten, I guess they'd gone on league night, which was something that they said on the documentary and also in the book, I believe. The book Deadly Dose by Amanda Lamb.
Lamb.
Yeah. So we read that book and it did say that it was league night and they had to wait for a lane, which was kind of unusual that they went on a league night for an outing, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, not a huge deal, but.
I guess they weren't frequent bowlers.
No, I don't think so.
But he became ill after drinking some of the beer.
Yeah, but he didn't really know it was that because they'd also bought hot dogs, right. Which are notoriously full of crap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so at first he thought he had food poisoning from the hot dog. And the outing had actually been encouraged by Eric's wife, Anne. So he was out with Anne's co-workers, and it was kind of an effort for him to get to know Anne's co-workers, from what I understand. Because Anne worked with a lot of guys, and Eric was getting kind of jealous of her interactions and relationships with these guys.
Absolutely, he was. He was even a little suspicious.
Yeah, with good reason.
As it turns out.
Yeah. Now, Anne had gone with him on similar outings, but that night it was just the guys. And Eric had been uncomfortable. He'd been kind of jealous of her relationship, especially with her co-worker, Daryl Willard. So Anne told Eric if he got to know Daryl better, he wouldn't be so uncomfortable. So that's why Eric was trying to be upbeat about it and give it a try for Anne.
Yeah.
To accommodate her.
Must have been difficult, though. I mean, here he is trying to do some bowling.
Yeah.
His stomach's killing him. He's vomiting. He even had to have a trash bag with him on the bowling alley so he'd throw the ball, go and vomit, stuff like that.
No, that's what makes me think such a nice guy. Who would do that? Why wouldn't you just say, I need to go home?
Yeah. Jeez.
But he really tried to do his best. And like you said, he had the trash can or a trash bag up there at the alley when they were bowling, trying to get through the night.
Yep. But he didn't.
No.
He ended up going to the hospital, or his wife took him to the hospital in the small hours of the morning.
Yeah, the outing was cut short, and while waiting for the bowling lane, when they went to the concession stand for hot dogs and they went to the bar for beer, there were some kind of strange things. Well, first of all, let's go back and say that, uncharacteristically, Daryl had purchased the pitcher of beer for the group. So he wasn't known to be treating people, but he went up to the concession stand, purchased a pitcher of beer, and then when he brought it over, it was odd because the glasses were already poured.
Yeah.
So the three glasses of beer were poured, and Daryl brought it over, and he handed each person their individual glass.
Mm-hmm.
And when Eric tasted his beer, he actually said to them that it tasted bitter.
Tasted funny, right?
Yeah, yep. I don't know if he said funny or bitter. I've heard different versions.
Or both.
But he made a comment about the taste.
There was something about the taste that was off.
But the other co-worker, the third guy, I guess it was, he said, that's just bowling alley beer. It's not great beer.
Right.
Not realizing that I'm sure his didn't taste as bad as Eric's did.
Well, you know, it's a pitcher. The tap lines never get cleaned. It's probably crappy beer to begin with.
Nothing that you're going to be reviewing anytime soon.
Not likely. Unless you want a special Bud Light review or something like that.
Well, I think maybe we should do like an on-the-road bowling alley episode sometime. That might be fun.
I'll keep that under advisement.
Could hear the balls crashing into the pins in the background. That's a possibility. But anyway, I digress. At some point, Daryl actually knocked over Eric's cup, spilling what was left of his beer. So that could be taken different ways.
Well, I think there's significance to it, as we'll find out later on.
Yeah.
I think the explanation is quite simple.
Well, Tell me, there's no need to wait.
Well, yes, there is.
Oh, okay.
You haven't even mentioned what he died of or anything and how they come to suspect what's going on.
Okay.
So I'm holding my cards in right now.
Okay. Well, anyway, Daryl did knock over Eric's cup before he finished his beer. And then it was midway through the game when Eric became violently ill. He did end up going home, even though he tried his best to continue bowling. And he thought he'd get better, but he didn't get any better. And as you said, his wife Anne rushed him to the hospital in the middle of the night. So he was admitted to the hospital. He was quite ill. And it was after 5 days there, the physicians at Rex Hospital really couldn't help him. They still didn't have a diagnosis.
Right. It wasn't a simple matter of food poisoning.
No. I mean, what kind of workup would you do if someone came in with these symptoms? Let's say, I know that you do children, but let's say it was a teenager, which isn't much different. What would you do if a young guy came in and gave you the story that Eric gave you?
Well, you look at the simplest explanation first. So he's got food poisoning or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to run some basic lab work.
Okay.
You're going to start an IV, give him fluids, probably make him nothing by mouth, just rest his gut, and expect within 24 hours he's much better.
So 5 days, what are you thinking?
So after a few days, then I'm thinking, okay, he's not better. There's no signs of illness in the sense that he hasn't run a fever or anything like that. So you worry then about intoxication with some chemical.
Oh, okay. Now, why wouldn't you think like Crohn's disease or something? You know, just saying out of the blue.
Those symptoms don't suggest inflammatory bowel disease.
Okay. Because of the nausea.
Because of the vomiting.
Okay.
And
that makes sense.
Fulminant Crohn's, you're going to run fever.
Oh, okay.
Same with colitis. I mean, you're going to be sick, but you're going to be a different kind of sick.
Yeah. So after 5 days.
Yeah. Plus, I'm sure they were resting his gut. So even the other illnesses with bowel rest would improve.
Right.
And they were probably giving him antispasmodics and different drugs to try to control his symptoms.
Sure.
And they're deciding, thinking, this is beyond our expertise. We need someone else to help out. So hence the transfer to the tertiary care medical center.
Right. Well, do you think at Rex Hospital he saw a gastroenterologist? Or would that have not played a factor because you think it's
Rex,
a chemical?
Rex is in Raleigh, right?
Yeah.
That's a big enough town. They probably had a GI consult.
Okay. But it wasn't anything that they could figure out.
No. Although they kind of did, as we'll find out down the road. They did the blood work.
Right, but they didn't have results.
Didn't have results.
Right.
But when he got transferred, they got the results.
No. When he got transferred, they did the blood work. They didn't get the results until the second admission, which was 2 weeks later. The results had been misplaced or mislabeled or something.
He got the results in North Carolina because they misinterpreted them as urine results and not blood results.
Oh, okay. So they didn't realize until the second admission.
So they came belatedly.
Yes.
And then they were misunderstood.
So they were misunderstood when he was at the university hospital?
Right.
Okay.
Because they looked at it and they didn't think that it was a severe enough level because they interpreted it as a urine sample, not a blood sample.
Well, how do you mix that up? I mean,
they just didn't read it.
Huh. But the person who ran it should have known. I just ran this on blood. It's high.
But that was at the referring hospital.
Okay.
They just sent the results along.
Okay. I see. So the other hospital misinterpreted the results from the first hospital.
Right.
And then they didn't realize it until his second admission at the first hospital again.
Right.
Okay. That was a little confusing, but now that's pretty clear. So the University of North Carolina physicians never developed a definitive diagnosis, but Eric did slowly recover there, and he was sent home. So he was admitted, I think it was November 15th. Does that sound right to you?
Sounds about right.
And he was sent home on November 24th.
Yeah.
So before Thanksgiving.
Just about a 10-day admission.
Right. So that was 10 days after his initial admission to Rex Hospital that he went home.
And he went home.
Yep.
Recovering.
Recovering, doing a lot better. So on November 30th, he was alone with Anne for the first night. So Anne warmed him up a chicken and rice dish that someone from her church had brought over for Eric. And he and Anne ate alone that night, and this was for the first time since he'd been home from the hospital, which is significant.
Yeah, his parents were down helping out, right?
Yep, his parents, Verus and Doris, they'd been in town since he became seriously ill.
Yep.
So they'd been there the whole time he was home. But that night, the two of them felt that Eric was on the road to recovery, and the two of them went out for dinner alone.
Yeah.
And left Anne and Eric to have dinner alone together at home.
Here's the sense of foreboding.
Yes. So his health was improving, and the family was thinking he was making a full recovery. They thought they were out of the woods.
Right.
Right?
Although they still didn't have a diagnosis.
No, they didn't.
I mean, it was there lurking in the background, but nobody had put the pieces together yet.
No.
But we're going to pretty soon.
Yeah. Because that night, Eric's symptoms recurred, and Anne ended up rushing him back to Rex Hospital.
Yes, more severe symptoms.
Yes, and after the next 24 hours, Eric's condition deteriorated greatly. His pain was very severe. He was getting morphine. He had convulsions. He had hallucinations. And this was the part that was really brought tears to my eyes, hearing his sisters talk about seeing him in the hospital in that condition.
Right.
Yeah, it was just horrible. Here's this young, nice guy, and he was seeing, like, devils and what else? Just horrible things.
Yeah.
He was convulsing. They had to restrain him.
They did.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, profuse vomiting and diarrhea.
Yeah.
The mental hallucinations, just not with it.
Yeah, it seems like mental and physical torture.
Right.
So his sisters just seemed heartbroken. One of the sisters actually said she had to lie across him to keep him in the bed at one point.
Yeah. And throughout all this, his wife is less concerned.
Yeah, she was at the bedside, but they did say that she said at some point she couldn't deal with it, and she walked out.
Right.
She couldn't deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, so not only was he killed, but he was tortured, and that's not an exaggeration to say that.
I don't think it is.
No, I think he really was. And the doctor still didn't know what was wrong with Eric. So, here he is deteriorating towards death. They don't know what's wrong with him. He's having, well, why don't you tell us now is probably a good time to tell us about arsenic poisoning. What was actually happening physiologically in Eric's body at this point?
So, okay. So what the cause of his death was,
yeah,
was arsenic poisoning.
Right.
He eventually died.
Sorry, I didn't mention that.
No, but that's okay. We knew where we were leading up to.
Well, I can just say on December 1st, the hospital did receive the lab results, and they did show massive amounts of arsenic in Eric's blood. But the damage was so far along that he couldn't be saved.
Right.
And he died the next day on December 2nd.
He did.
Yeah. So what happened to him with the arsenic?
So arsenic poisoning is a condition caused by elevated levels of arsenic in the body.
Sure.
That's straightforward.
Right.
The dominant basis for arsenic poisoning is from groundwater.
Hmm.
So
okay.
It's pretty ubiquitous. A 2007 study found over 100 million people in over 70 countries with chronic arsenic exposure.
Okay, but this is exposure. It's not
right.
Killing them.
So these are people that have constant exposure to low levels and do okay.
Okay.
But it can be a poison, obviously.
Right.
In fact, in 19th century England, arsenic was the drug of choice of murderers.
Wow. How did they determine that?
Well, the reason it was the drug of choice was because the symptoms manifest something other than the arsenic poisoning. So vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, convulsions, hallucinations.
All things that they said Eric had.
Headaches, confusion, drowsiness. I mean, all these things.
That sounds like hell.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. It does.
So, and eventually you become comatose and die. So, and it works on the body by inhibiting an enzyme that's essential for the energy systems of cells. So it disrupts this enzyme, which basically makes the cells die. And depending on which organ is more affected, you get those symptoms. So you can have heart rhythm disturbances. You can have central nervous system confusion, hallucinations, seizures. You can have kidney disease. You can have liver disease. You can have all sorts of organs affected by arsenic.
So the organs just aren't working anymore like they should.
They can't work because their energy systems are screwed up.
Okay. What is that? The energy of the cell is, I'm trying to think back to biology.
Adenosine triphosphate.
Yes, there we go. ADP.
ATP. And ADP.
Okay. But we don't have to get that in depth.
So, and you can measure it, obviously. You can measure it in blood, urine, hair, and fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
For acute poisoning, urine is the most accurate method.
Oh.
So I think that's where the Chapel Hill docs, they see the elevated level of arsenic and they just assume it's urine because that's the test you run.
Now, why is that? Do you know why that's more, it's more accurate than the blood test?
No, not more accurate, just more able to be tested.
Oh, it's just an easier test to run?
Right.
Okay.
Now, for chronic exposure over months, hair is the best way to check it. And nails also. And we're going to find out the exquisite studies they did on his hairs.
Yeah, the hair plays a big role in the forensics.
And what they could show was that he had been kind of chronically poisoned. It was like his wife, who pled guilty eventually. I'm giving this away.
It's okay.
but I think people know where we're leading.
Yeah.
But the thought was that she was trying practice runs on him to see how he responded to small levels and see what was going on.
Okay.
Before she gave him the big dose that killed him.
Yeah. Now, was arsenic more available to people in the old days? You know, some things you could buy right over the counter that you can't
now? You could walk into an apothecary and buy it.
Yeah.
And it's been used medicinally.
Really?
Yeah.
For what?
Well, traditional Chinese medicine has used it for thousands of years.
To do what? Do you know?
A variety of treatments.
Okay.
In Elizabethan England, it was mixed into a paste that was used to lighten the skin.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And just to finish this little treatise on arsenic,
there's
some famous people that have been poisoned.
And killed?
And killed.
Okay.
Or likely killed, or likely poisoned.
Because, of course, there was no testing for it.
Right. Well, they've done testing in modern times on remains.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So George III of England, Mad King George, whose reign was interrupted many times by bouts of mental illness.
Wow.
His hairs were positive for arsenic, so the postulate is that he was poisoned.
And that would explain his behavior.
Which it could.
Wow.
Simón Bolívar, the South American independence leader.
Yeah.
And more interesting, Napoleon.
Really?
Really. So those are some famous people.
Right.
There is a racehorse thrown in there, too, that was poisoned.
Why would someone poison a racehorse? Like a competitor?
Yeah.
Scumbags.
So, but arsenic is a nasty thing. I mean, you can ingest it without really knowing that you're taking it in.
Right.
I mean, Eric was thinking the beer tasted off. It probably did a little bit.
A little bit.
But he was likely or was ingesting quantities of it for some time before he actually died and never commented on the taste of the meal.
Yeah, it could probably be masked in different flavors if it's not a super strong taste. So because the arsenic could have been intentionally poisoning him, obviously, the police were notified and detectives examined Eric's lab where he worked, for sources where he could have been accidentally exposed to arsenic because he worked in a AIDS research lab.
Right, but there was no arsenic in his lab.
No, nope.
However.
But his background and his friends and coworkers were also investigated, and then they searched their home and they didn't find anything there.
However, again.
But when police searched Ann's lab, they did find an arsenic compound, and I'm going to try and say it, cacodylic acid.
Right.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what do they use that for cleaning glassware? Are you aware of that?
Yeah.
You're familiar with that? And it's arsenic containing, or it's pretty much just arsenic?
No, it's arsenic containing.
Okay.
But it's a liquid, so you know, you can mix it into things pretty easily.
Yeah.
I don't know what how soluble the powder is and how easy that would be.
Right.
To disguise, but certainly the liquid could be administered easily.
Sure. So when they examined Anne's work computer, after they found that, they were like, oh, well, that's a little suspicious, but it's certainly not proof of anything.
Right.
So they searched her
work. There's a perfectly innocent explanation for having the compound in her lab.
Sure. It's just a little something to look at because
right.
her husband's been poisoned
her
with it.
Her husband's just been fatally poisoned with it. So
when they examined her work computer, they found emails that proved that Anne was having affairs with other men.
Yeah, not just one guy.
No, not just one, but most significantly, she had been having an affair with Daryl Willard, a coworker.
Her coworker.
And Daryl Willard had been the one who took him bowling the night he had the
right.
the first severe illness where he was hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the hypothesis that they arrived at down the road was that this was the first significant attempt at killing Eric.
Yes.
And that the beer was spilled by Daryl
mm-hmm.
because he chickened out.
Well, chickened out, I don't know if I'd put it that way.
Well,
it
seemed like it was intentionally spilled.
Yes, which I wouldn't call chickened out. I'd say maybe he came to his senses.
Okay.
Right? But there were many emails between Anne and Daryl which were very romantic, and at times they were sexually explicit.
Well, yeah.
And by the way, Daryl was also married.
With the child.
Yes. Now, just at this point, I didn't finish the book because I've been busy doing the research and the computer stuff. So Dick's the only one that read 100% of the book. And there was something about Daryl before Anne latched onto him. He was kind of down in the dumps. Something made him vulnerable, right?
He seemed to be very quiet and kind of depressed.
Yeah.
And then his coworkers noticed that after Anne started paying attention to him, he brightened up considerably and seemed a lot happier.
So the idea there is that Anne saw him as someone that could be easily manipulated.
I think she saw a person who would be able to be manipulated.
Right.
And she could work her spell on him.
So it's possible this was all planned before she even got involved with Daryl.
Oh, I bet it
was. Or more than possible. Maybe probable?
Probable is for sure.
That's what the investigator seemed to think that.
Yeah.
What was he? Lieutenant Morgan.
Right.
He was a lieutenant at the end, right?
He got promoted to lieutenant.
Yeah. But based on these emails, Anne and Daryl had first gotten together in October of 2000. And they'd spent a weekend together in early November. And on this weekend, they'd flown side by side to Chicago on a Friday. They checked into the Ritz-Carlton there. And pretty much stayed in the room living on room service. So we know what they were probably doing.
Well, they were probably doing things of a sexual nature.
Yes. And they returned home on Sunday night.
Right. And this was, Anne told her husband it was a business trip.
Yeah.
Daryl told his wife it was a reunion weekend. So they each had different stories.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah. Well, also, when they checked in as Mr. and Mrs. Daryl Willard.
Right.
Right. So he probably used his credit card.
Probably did.
I don't know if you can check into a hotel like that without a credit card.
No, you can't.
Probably can't just pay cash.
I don't think so.
No.
Well, maybe you could, but...
Maybe. But this made investigators look back at the bowling alley outing, of course, when Eric first became ill. And Daryl Willard had actually planned that outing. And like I said, he'd served Eric his glass of beer that he drank right before he became violently ill that night.
Yes.
So the co-workers that they interviewed said it was unusual for Daryl to plan an outing. He wasn't like an outgoing sort of guy that was planning outings.
There were several unusual features about this outing.
Yeah. So it kind of led us to believe that it was Anne's idea for Daryl to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Daryl backed out of it, I guess.
Right.
So the investigators interviewed Daryl, and Daryl, he insisted that he had nothing to do with Eric's death, but he seemed kind of awkward in the interview, according to Detective or Lieutenant Morgan.
He thought of Daryl as a person of interest pretty quickly.
He did, yeah.
And was planning on questioning him some more.
Yeah, Detective Morgan told Daryl that from emails, etc., He thought that Daryl had been used by a woman, and Daryl actually answered something like, she's doing a mighty good job, too.
Right.
So he kind of conceded that something was up there.
He did.
Yeah.
But then shortly after, he ended the interview and lawyered up. He said he wasn't talking anymore without his lawyer.
Yeah, well, he wasn't stupid.
No. So they did get a search warrant. They searched his home, didn't find anything significant. They did, however, continue to believe that Daryl had given Eric the arsenic at the bowling alley.
Now, this was just based on the fact that, well, the guy who went with them must have been interviewed and said that Daryl handed out the beers individually.
Right. Well, I think if they look at things about Daryl wasn't the type of guy to do something like this, he wasn't the type of guy who would spring for a pitcher of beer.
Right.
They found the emails between Daryl and Ann.
Now, there were no emails that actually talked about a plot to kill Eric, though,
no,
were there?
No, but they found that there was an affair going on between them.
Right.
So they got a lot of circumstantial stuff.
Well, and she was also emailing this Chris somebody that she'd had an affair with before who lived in San Diego or something.
Right. Mankiewicz or something like that.
And they actually, some of the investigators thought he might have been the real one that she wanted to be with, and she was using Daryl to get rid of Eric so she could be with Chris.
Possibly.
Possibly.
They didn't have that long a relationship.
No.
And he was the one who broke it off.
Yeah, which might make you think that she wasn't done with him.
Right.
Right.
She was.
Or she still had feelings for him.
Or she still had feelings for him.
Because they were still in contact pretty close to Eric's death.
They were.
Yeah.
So Eric Miller's family was adamant that Anne didn't have anything to do with the murder.
No, they liked her.
They believed she was innocent, and they were very protective of her.
Yeah.
So they're all pointing the finger at old Daryl.
Yeah, there was actually a part in the book where they'd gone to the Miller's house, and Anne was there with them.
Right.
And they'd actually, Anne had hid in the bathroom and refused to speak to them.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Daryl's parents actually protected her from the police, saying there's no way she would have done that.
No.
She would have had anything to do with it. No way.
Yeah, and she further strengthened that thought at the funeral.
At Eric's funeral.
She was quite emotional.
Yeah.
Sobbing throughout the service, inconsolable afterwards, crying out, why? Was convinced many of Eric's friends and relatives that Anne couldn't have been responsible for Eric's murder.
Right, right.
So people even might have felt guilty for having doubted her.
Yeah, there was one friend that was interviewed on, I think it was on the Forensic Files. There's a Forensic Files episode, I think it's called Hairline, where they talked a lot about how they did the hair.
That's as good as Pretty Poison.
And this one was a lot about how they used the hair evidence. But they did interview a friend of Eric's who said he felt guilty after the service that he doubted Anne at all because she just seemed so heartbroken.
Well, his doubts were well placed.
Yeah, they were, but it would turn out.
So then the plot thickens.
Oh.
After the funeral service at 5:30 the next day, Daryl's wife came home from work and found him dead in the garage of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He left a note, but it wasn't a confession.
No, it wasn't a confession.
But it did apologize. It alluded to something that he had gotten into, or
that he'd been accused of something he didn't do.
Right.
And he was sorry for leaving them.
And his reputation was smeared, and this was the only way out.
Yeah, so it seems like he did have a conscience.
Yeah, well, he did, because he didn't complete the poisoning.
Well, I know, but Amanda Lamb, in her interview, she said that he was actually a good guy, but if he was really a good guy, he probably wouldn't have put the poison in the beer to begin with. Or at the first sip, he would have knocked it away. But he actually let him sip on it a while before he knocked it over, so
yeah,
he wasn't totally a good guy.
No, I think he had his eyes on the prize for a while.
Yeah.
He was going to get Anne.
He was led astray, but also he's an adult man, so he is responsible for doing that.
Oh, I don't condone his actions at all.
No, I don't either. I don't either. The note was an apology to his family, and he did say that he was wrongfully accused of murdering Eric. Now, by saying that, he didn't say, I didn't have anything to do with it. So he might have been saying, I didn't kill him.
Right.
But he knew that he would be indicted for involvement in it anyway.
He knew that something was going to happen. And he had seen a lawyer.
Right. And we'll get to that.
He'd spoken with a lawyer.
That's right. That's a big part of the case.
It's going to be the whole crux of the case.
Yeah, it eventually is. They did interview Daryl's widow, Yvette, and Yvette said that Daryl had confessed to his affair with Anne to her, but he told Anne he had nothing to do with Eric's death. And she also said Eric had been to see his lawyer, and that was Richard Gammon, who was a pretty well-known lawyer in the area.
He's a former cop.
Yeah, with a good reputation.
Yep, he was a good guy.
Yep. And according to Yvette, Richard Gammon had told Daryl that he would probably be charged with attempted murder. So this is probably what put Daryl over the edge, decided to take his own life.
I think so.
Which he'd already had some depression prior, so he might have been leaning in that direction as a person.
Yes.
And this led investigators to believe that Daryl had shared information with Richard Gammon that might be significant. But Richard Gammon, he was citing client attorney privilege and refused to hand over that information. And he fought with the investigators' efforts to have the information that Daryl had shared with him released to the prosecutor. But he did eventually comply after there were failed appeals, and that wasn't until 2003. So I know you know a little bit more about that. Is there anything you want to say about that before we move on?
Well, this was a long, drawn-out process.
Yeah, that's like 2 years later.
Here's the interesting thing from the book. The attorney, Gammon, called Morgan, the lead investigator in the crime.
Right.
About another case.
Oh, okay.
And they were discussing that case.
Yes.
And Morgan says to Gammon, because he knew that he was Daryl's attorney.
Right.
He said, is there anything you could tell me about his notes or your conversations with him? And of course, Gammon cites lawyer-client privilege.
Right.
But then said something that kind of sounded cryptic but turned out to be prophetic, maybe you should go to court and try to get those records.
Right. The prosecutor wasn't really interested in doing that at the time, right?
No, the prosecutor wasn't. There was apparently many battles between the police and the prosecutor. They wanted him to move forward with it. So what they ended up doing was taking an end around the prosecutor and going to another prosecutor.
Oh, how do you do that?
They just presented the cases to him.
Oh, so he was just another lawyer in the same prosecutor's office.
Right.
Okay.
So they agreed to go ahead with it, further pissing off the initial prosecutor.
Yeah, I'm sure he wasn't happy about that. No, a lot of egos involved in this stuff, unfortunately.
So they went before a judge in order to get Gammon, the lawyer, to give up his client information.
Right.
The judge ruled that he would listen to what Gammon had to say, and then he would rule on what, if any, would be admissible.
Right, and they decided that parts of the conversation, because they were about a third party, Anne, that those would be admissible, right?
There was actually a very small amount that was deemed admissible.
Okay.
Because obviously nothing that incriminated Daryl was going to be admissible.
Right, even though he died.
Even though he died.
Right.
You don't lose the attorney-client privilege.
Well, that's what they were trying to argue, though, is that you do, because you can't incriminate yourself after you die.
No, but the judge was strictly enforcing that.
Yeah.
So anything that was incriminating the client was not allowed.
Okay.
But what was allowed was the bombshell.
Yeah.
He said that Anne told him that she injected her husband with arsenic.
Yes, right.
So, boom, we got her.
Right, yeah. So is that all you have on that? Do you have anything more over there? I know you had some notes.
So the judge says we'll allow this. It went through a couple appeals. I mean, it took like 2 years or so to get the appeals.
Yeah, it was a long battle, really.
But by the spring of 2004, when we're getting ready to come before a grand jury, Anne had moved to Wilmington, North Carolina. That's the far south coast.
Right.
Moved with her daughter, Claire. And she had been dating and eventually remarried. She is now Anne Kontz, K-O-N-T-Z.
Yeah.
She was living what seemed to be an average domestic life with her husband, Paul, who was a painter or something and a member of a Christian rock band.
Yeah, and I guess he was a neighbor of Anne's sister that watched Claire during the day.
He was a neighbor.
Yeah. Because there were a couple times when she dropped Claire off and pretended to go to work, but actually went to Paul's house.
Right.
Before they were officially together.
Spent the work day.
So according to Detective Morgan, she had already been in a relationship with Paul less than 6 months after Eric's death.
Right.
Which he thought was kind of speedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in September of 2004, Anne appeared before the grand jury, the Wake County grand jury, and they indicted her for murder. So finally, by this time, Eric's family no longer defended Anne.
Yeah.
When the prosecutors read Gammon's notes at Anne's bond hearing, it was the first time anyone had heard of her confession to Daryl.
Right. So that was the first time that it was out there.
Right.
Even Anne, she didn't know about Daryl going to the lawyer, no. Right? Yeah.
Anne looked shocked that this information was in the hands of the prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's pretty rare to get bond in a first-degree murder trial.
I would imagine.
But they were there appealing for bond because she's been a good citizen. She's staying in the state. She's taking care of her daughter. She's employed, blah, blah, blah. She had numbers of character witnesses.
Right, right.
So the judge went ahead and offered bond, but he set it so high that she couldn't possibly make it.
Right, $3 million.
$3 million bond. So she remained in prison.
Yeah.
Awaiting trial.
Yeah. But the prosecutors were worried that a jury would have difficulty convicting Anne for many of the reasons you just mentioned.
Yeah, there is a lot written about that in the book.
Yeah.
They were worried that they could get a hung jury.
Right.
Because it was a lot of circumstantial stuff. And basically the case hinged on the testimony of the dead guy.
Daryl. Yep.
So the defense offered a plea bargain.
Right, right. Yeah, because Anne didn't look like a criminal. She was articulate, attractive, the mother of a young child, like you said, and of course no criminal history.
Right.
Right. So they offered her the plea deal with the approval of Eric's family. So it was on November 8th of 2005, that's like 4 years later, that Anne pled guilty to second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder, and that was in exchange for 25 years in prison.
Right.
Right? But had Anne gone to trial, a big part of the evidence would have been the arsenic levels obtained from the samples of Eric's hair. And there was a lot about this in the Forensic Files episode.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So these levels actually helped them to determine when Eric was poisoned. The hair samples provided scientists with 6 months of Eric's history of arsenic levels.
Yes.
Yep. So they actually used a process called neutron activation, and Eric's hair samples were cut into 5-millimeter sections. Now, each section represented about 2 weeks in his life.
Mm-hmm.
So the sections could determine the poisoning within 2-week increments. But see, that was the problem. You couldn't really say, oh, it was this day at this time.
Exactly.
That he got it. So that's why they were worried about getting a conviction with her.
Right.
Yeah.
They could show the duration of time that
when
he'd,
it
been,
started,
that he'd
right.
been exposed to arsenic.
Yeah, he got a large dose of arsenic poisoning in the 2-week period that included his first hospitalization. So that was after the bowling incident.
Right.
And that was what convinced investigators that Eric had been poisoned by Daryl Willard at the bowling alley.
Yes.
But Daryl didn't really want to kill Eric, as we think. And that's why he spilled the remainder of Eric's beer, and Eric didn't actually die from the arsenic poisoning, although he actually could have. He came very close to it.
He was critically ill.
Yes, he
for
was.
For sure.
You don't stay in the hospital for 10 days over nothing. That's very unusual.
No, you don't.
They get you in and out. So interestingly enough, Anne told police that she was at home while Eric was at the bowling alley with Daryl. But Anne Miller's cell phone records showed that she used it in close proximity to the bowling alley that evening.
Mm-hmm.
So that was around 7:20 p.m. She used her phone, and she also called her home from her cell and checked her voicemail, her home voicemail from her cell.
Yeah.
And that call pinged off the same tower near the bowling alley.
Right.
So we pretty much know that Anne was at the bowling alley, parking lot or whatever.
In pretty close proximity to it.
So she was kind of there urging Daryl on, probably gave him the stuff. Who knows?
Right.
But she seemed to really have a strong hand in the incident.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might have even been similar to Pam Smart, where she's saying, well, you kill my husband or we're done, you know.
Could have been.
Could have been something like that. But the most surprising information that I thought was that the hair analysis showed that the poisoning had been going on for months. Eric had been poisoned multiple times over the six-month period. So starting back in July of that year, he'd been getting doses of arsenic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think she was kind of titrating the dose.
You think so?
To see what amount she would need to give him to cause his death.
Right.
And she's trying, you know, she has no idea. I'll try a little bit and see what happens. next time I'll try a little bit more.
She was pretty crazy.
Well, you have to be.
Well, yeah. But there were also two other theories about why she did it. There was one that she wanted to torture Eric, because it was a torturous way to die.
It certainly was. I'm not sure that that's a reason for why she did it.
Well, and a stronger theory, I think, is that she wanted to show a pattern of Eric becoming sicker and sicker over several months so that when he did die, it wouldn't look so much like a homicide.
Right.
It might look more like an illness or an accidental exposure thing that killed him over a time period.
Yeah, although I guess she didn't give him enough at the bowling alley to make him die. I mean, I think if he had gotten the fatal dose at the bowling alley and had died that night,
yeah,
they might not have ever looked at heavy metals or arsenic.
Really?
Yeah.
Why not? If he died, wouldn't they do all the blood work? They do an autopsy?
Well, they do an autopsy, but they might not look for arsenic.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I wondered, because if they might find something that could have caused it, like some kind of condition he had.
Yeah.
Which they sometimes do, even though that wouldn't be the real cause of his death.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting.
So, but Anne's in jail.
Right.
Her sister and brother-in-law are the legal guardians of Anne and Eric's daughter, Claire.
Yes.
So in 2007, Varys and Doris Miller, Eric's parents, sought a court order to block Anne's visitation rights. So apparently she would go to see her mom in prison.
Well, she'd never actually been, but she did have the right to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they frequently fly from their home in Indiana to Wilmington to spend time with their granddaughter. They've said that they don't think it's in her best interest to see her mother in prison. She's allowed to speak with her on the phone. And they've talked pretty much twice weekly over the years.
Right. Yep. But Claire's almost 17 years old now.
Yes.
So I was looking into it, and there's really surprisingly little research about whether visiting a parent in prison is harmful or if it's helpful. Now, overall, experts say that these situations need to be assessed on an individual basis. But in an extreme case like this, where a mom killed the child's dad, the guardians really need to be careful, which seems obvious to me.
Yeah. And I can see where it would be on an individual case-by-case basis, because there's crimes of passion that just erupt.
Yeah.
And there's...
Well, there are nonviolent crimes, of course.
Right.
Where the parent's going to get out and they're going to have a relationship, so they need to maintain that relationship.
Yeah.
But in something like this, where she's killed the child's father and she's probably never getting out of prison...
And she's apologized for it, but she's not real repentant.
Well, she's apologized for having a part in it, but she's never said that she, you know, was in charge of it.
Yeah.
But according to Danielle Wilson, Anne's sister who has raised Claire, Anne has taken full responsibility for her crime. And because of that, she's been able to have a relationship with her daughter through the phone calls and the letters. So if a teenager feels strongly about visiting her parent in prison, it's probably best to allow it with proper preparation, with guidance, and with counseling. Because if you just keep them from seeing them no matter what, you know how teenagers are.
Right.
I mean, how do you feel about that?
I'd agree with that as a teenager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a younger child, no.
I think for this crime, you got to think that mom's a sociopath.
Well, of course, add her to our list of sociopaths, right. Which gets longer
and
longer.
I'm not sure I'd want a 6-year-old exposed to that.
Right. Well, she certainly wouldn't be left alone with her.
No, but that's beside the point.
Okay.
The lady's nuts.
Yes. But But a lot of kids have crazy parents. Does that mean they shouldn't be around them?
Well, they have crazy parents that don't murder people.
Yeah, true. Good point. But does the fact that she did plead guilty without going through the trial, does that give you any sympathy toward Anne?
Not at all.
No.
She took the easier way out. I mean, I know she could have been found guilty of first-degree murder and either been sentenced to death or a life in prison.
Oh, so the death penalty was an option.
It would have been. They hadn't gotten to the point of really deciding whether they're going to argue for the death penalty or not.
Okay.
Because they were kind of waiting to see what the defense was offering.
Yes.
But that had been a consideration.
Well, it's funny. It seems like the prosecution and the defense were kind of afraid what a jury might do.
Right.
And were happier to reach this agreement.
Yeah. They were probably not going to plead for the death penalty because Eric's parents were against it.
Oh, even after they thought she did it?
Right.
Oh.
But that was, you know, it hadn't come to that point where they had to make a real decision because she pled out.
Okay. Do you have any idea what happened with her new husband, Paul?
I have no idea.
Okay. I don't either. So that wasn't brought up at the end of the book?
No.
Okay. So you don't have any more sympathy for her because she pled guilty?
No, I don't. I think she just looked at this and, you know, the prosecution's worried that she could walk. She's worried that she might be found guilty.
Yeah, so she took it. She cut a pretty good deal.
25 years.
It's a long time, though. I might take my chances with that.
Well, so what was she, 30 years old?
Yeah.
When it happened? So she'll only be in her mid-50s.
Well, when you're 30, that sounds old. Mid-50s.
Yeah.
It's a big chunk of the prime of your life.
But it sounds better than being in there forever.
Sure. But my big questions are over her motive. Now, her motive really wasn't money because he only had a $100,000 life insurance policy. And even though he didn't have a big money job, he did have his doctorate and made a good living.
Yes, he did.
So she wasn't making any more money. And actually, when she moved to Wilmington, she was working in a store and her class in life, her financial status went down quite a bit.
It sure did.
Now, I don't think it was, and nobody thinks it was, to be with Daryl.
No, it wasn't. He was just a pawn.
Right.
And maybe it was to be with the San Diego guy.
Maybe.
But he broke up with her.
Yeah, but he broke up with her before this plot happened. Did she think he was going to come back if she was a widow?
Possibly.
So there was also the issue of, is it better to be a widow than a divorcee? Because you get sympathy as being a widow, and I don't know if there's a lot of negative backfire by being divorced nowadays. It's pretty normal.
Yeah.
But she seemed to think, some people think, that she thought she'd do better as a widow in public opinion than as a divorcee.
You get more sympathy votes as a widow.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. And what about this whole idea of magical thinking?
Well, I mean, that's part of her sociopathy.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole magical thinking is basically that the world revolves around you.
Yeah, and that you can do whatever.
And you can do anything.
Yeah.
So
we don't know what causes that, but you think it's a personality.
Yeah.
And that kind of personality is probably a combination of
sociopathy,
born with it, and the
narcissism.
Yeah.
Other personality disorders.
Right.
I mean, we keep coming back to this, but I'm thinking that's got to be a common trait among murderers.
Yeah, narcissism seems like a big one with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good discussion. Anything else you want to add?
I think I'm done.
Okay. So thanks for listening to this episode, Pretty Poison. And we'll be back probably later in the week with our next episode. We probably won't wait another week.
No, we won't. We'll do something midweek or so.
Yeah, because we're still on our Killer Wives series. This was number 2 in our Killer Wives series.
We got
series.
One more to do.
Yep.
So.
Okay.
We'll do another one.
We will.
And then we'll look into some other cases that have been suggested to us. There's a lot of interesting things out there.
Right. Oh, before we end, I just wanted to let everyone know that we do have some Amazon affiliate links on our website now. So if you're going to do your Christmas shopping, there are some links on our website, tigrabber.com, where if you click on those links to do your shopping through Amazon, it won't cost you anything extra, but Amazon will throw a few pennies our way. I think it's like 4%, something like that. But it can help support the podcast.
That's right, because we don't charge anything for these podcasts.
No.
These are freebies.
Free bonus for everybody.
Right.
That's right.
Because we enjoy doing them.
We do. Okay. And we can also be listened to on Google Play, on Stitcher, and of course on iTunes. If you have time, give us a like on Facebook. We're trying to build up some likes there and some followers on Instagram and on Twitter. On Twitter, our name is at TigrabberPods. And we're always putting up what's to come on our next episodes on Twitter, on Facebook, and more recently a lot on Instagram about what's coming up on the next episode, what you have to look forward to.
So keep your eyes peeled.
Yep. And Frankie White, we're going to send you an email tonight, and you'll be getting your snifter this week.
Okay, Frankie.
And thanks to everyone who sent in 5-star reviews for that contest. We will be having another contest soon, I promise.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. So until then, we will be at the quiet end of the bar.
Nursing our beers.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, folks.